This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Deadly Companions, How Microbes Shaped Our History, by Dorothy H. Crawford, narrated by Jennifer M. Dixon. Preface. Microbes first appeared on planet Earth around 4 billion years ago, and have coexisted with us ever since we evolved from our ape-like ancestors. By colonizing our bodies, these tiny creatures profoundly influenced our evolution, and by causing epidemics that killed significant numbers of our predecessors, they helped to shape our history. Through most of this coexistence, our ancestors had no idea what caused these visitations, and were powerless to stop them. Indeed, the first microbe was only discovered some 130 years ago, and since then we have tried many ingenious ways to stop them from invading our bodies and causing disease. But despite some remarkable successes, microbes are still responsible for 14 million deaths a year. In fact, new microbes are now emerging with increasing frequency, while old adversaries, like tuberculosis and malaria, have resurged with renewed vigor. This book explores the links between the emergence of microbes and the cultural evolution of the human race. It combines an historical account of major epidemics with an up-to-date understanding of the culprit microbes. Their impact is discussed in the context of contemporary social and cultural events in order to show why they emerged at particular stages in our history and how they caused such devastation. We begin with SARS, the first pandemic of the 21st century. Then we travel back in time to the origin of microbes and see how they evolved to infect and spread between us with such apparent ease. From there, we follow the interlinked history of man and microbes from the plagues and pestilence of ancient times to the modern era, identifying key factors in human cultural changes from hunter-gatherer to farmer to city-dweller, which made us vulnerable to microbe attack. The final chapters show how modern discoveries and inventions have impacted on today's global burden of infectious diseases, and ask how, in an ever more crowded world, we can overcome the threat of emerging microbes. Will pathogenic microbes be conquered by a fight to the death policy? Or is it time to take a more microbe-centric view of the problem? Our continued disruption of their environment will inevitably lead to more conflict with more microbes, but now that we appreciate the extent of the problem, surely we can find a way of living in harmony with our microscopic cohabitants of the planet. Throughout this book, the term microbe is used for any organism that is microscopic, be it a bacterium, virus, or protozoan. Fungi are also included, since although their vegetative growth is often visible to the naked eye, the spores that spread them from one host to another are microscopic. None of these tiny life forms have brains, so despite the fact that they often appear ingenious and manipulative, they have no facilities to think or plan. The human characteristics often attributed to them actually come about by their ability to adapt rapidly to changing situations. Then the natural process of survival of the fittest ensures that the best adapted prosper, so that in the end they really do seem to lie in wait for a suitable host and then jump, attack, invade, and target. Although these descriptions seem apt and are frequently used in the texts of this book to illustrate the lives of microbes, in reality, microbes are not capable of malice aforethought. Wherever possible, the scientific terms used in the book are defined in the text. Introduction. When SARS first hit an unsuspecting world in 2003, the press had no need to dramatize or embellish. the true story certainly rivaled any modern thriller with a mysterious killer virus on the loose in southern China, innocently carried in a human incubator to its international launch pad in Hong Kong. From there, the virus jetted round the world, infecting over 8,000 people in 27 countries. 800 people died before the virus was eventually brought under control 4 months later. The whole alarming episode began in November 2002 with an outbreak of an untreatable atypical pneumonia in the city of Foshan in Guangdong Province, China, and by January 2003 similar cases were turning up in Guangdong's capital city, Guangzhou. The virus was probably transported there by a travelling seafood merchant who was admitted to the city's hospital and sparked a major outbreak there. By the time the World Health Organization, WHO, got to hear about it just 3 months after the start of the epidemic, there had been 302 cases and at least 5 deaths, too late to stop it snowballing out of control. At first, the microbe spread only locally within China, but in February 2003, after a 65-year-old doctor who worked in a hospital in Guangzhou arrived in Hong Kong to attend a wedding, it went global. The doctor checked into room 911 on the 9th floor of the Metropole Hotel, and by the time he was admitted to hospital, 24 hours later, he had infected at least 17 others in the hotel. These people then departed to their various destinations, carrying the virus with them to 5 separate countries and spawning major epidemics in Vietnam, Singapore, and Canada. The chain of infection widened as they passed the virus on in hospitals, clinics, hotels, workplaces, homes, trains, taxis, and aeroplanes. A single virus-carrying passenger on one flight infected 22 of the 119 other travellers. SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome, begins with a flu-like illness, but instead of improving after a week or so, it progresses to pneumonia. Sufferers feel feverish and increasingly breathless, with a persistent cough, as the virus colonizes the air sacs of the lungs, damaging their delicate lining and filling them with fluid. By the time they seek medical help, many are fighting for breath and are immediately shipped to intensive care units for mechanical ventilation. The cough generates a spray of tiny virus-laden mucus droplets, so anyone in the vicinity is in danger of picking up the infection. Family members are at high risk, and before the danger was appreciated, many healthcare workers were among the casualties after struggling to save lives by clearing airways, artificially ventilating and resuscitating patients. A young Hong Kong resident who visited a friend at the Metropole Hotel on the day the SARS-infected doctor was in residence was later admitted to Hong Kong's Prince of Wales Hospital, where he started an outbreak among doctors, nurses, students, patients, visitors, and relatives that eventually resulted in 100 cases. One of these carried the virus to Amoy Gardens, a private housing estate in Hong Kong, where it spread like wildfire. Over 300 people on the estate caught the infection, and 42 died. Although SARS is mainly spread by coughing, the virus is excreted in feces, and since most SARS victims develop watery diarrhea, this is another possible route of infection. In fact, diarrhea was a prominent feature among the Amoy Gardens SARS victims, and some experts think the unprecedented attack rate there was caused by a partially blocked sewage system, which, combined with strong exhaust fans in the toilets, created a rising plume of contaminated warm air in the air shaft that spread to living quarters throughout the building. Thus, the epidemic in Hong Kong took off, infecting some 1,755 people before it was brought under control. Meanwhile, the virus arrived in the US and Canada, seeded directly from the Metropole Hotel in Hong Kong. And although it did not spread in the US, the virus took hold in Toronto before doctors realized what was happening. 6 of the first 10 cases were from the family of an elderly couple who stayed at the Metropole Hotel, 9th floor, while visiting their son in Hong Kong. Their family doctor became the 7th victim, and although she recovered, an elderly man who happened to be in the hospital emergency department at the same time as one of the family caught the virus and died. The microbe then moved out into the Greater Toronto area, infecting 438 and killing 43 before its spread was finally halted. Dr. Carlo Urbani, a WHO infectious disease expert working with a team from Médecins Sans Frontières at the French hospital in Hanoi, Vietnam, was among the first to recognize SARS as a new and dangerous infection and to note its high rate among healthcare workers, who accounted for 30 of the first 60 cases in Hanoi. By warning the world of its dangers, they ensured instigation of the necessary precautions worldwide, but sadly, it was too late for Dr. Urbani. He felt the ominous symptoms developing during a flight from Hanoi to Bangkok and alerted the authorities on his arrival. He battled with the virus for 18 days in a makeshift isolation room in Bangkok Hospital, but died at the end of March. 5 of his colleagues also fell victim to the disease. WHO's global health alert, issued on the 12th of March, caused long unused traditional public health measures to swing into action. These included routine isolation of SARS cases and quarantine for anyone who had contracted a case to prevent spread in hospitals, while travel restrictions with country entry and exit screening were imposed to interrupt the microbe spread in the community. These precautions, along with a high-profile media awareness campaign, brought the pandemic under control by July 2003. But before the whole episode was over, there was a final sting in the tail. In late 2003, the virus jumped to 2 laboratory workers, one in Singapore, the other in Taiwan, while they were handling it. Fortunately, these infections were not fatal, and there was no further spread, but then in spring 2004, 2 more laboratory workers, this time in Beijing, developed SARS, precipitating an outbreak of 6 further cases and 1 death. By the end of the pandemic, there had been over 8,000 SARS cases and 800 deaths involving 32 countries. Worst affected was China, with 2/3 of cases and 1/3 of deaths. Despite the death toll, the whole episode must be regarded as a victory for those who worked so hard to contain the microbe. It could have been a lot worse. As it was, it cost an estimated $140 billion, mostly from reduced travel to and investment in Asia. In contrast to the rather medieval-sounding quarantine measures that were needed to curtail the spread of the SARS virus, the search for the culprit used 21st-century molecular technology and was accomplished with amazing speed. A coronavirus, so-called because of its crown-like structure, was identified in SARS victims by the end of March 2003 and confirmed to be the cause by the middle of April, just 2 months after the doctor in Hong Kong initiated its global spread. These days, a completely new human microbe, like the SARS coronavirus, is most likely to be a zoonosis, an animal microbe that has jumped from its natural host to humans. And since more than a third of the early SARS sufferers in Guangdong were food or animal handlers, scientists hunting for its origin headed for the wet markets of Guangdong, where wild animals are sold live for the table. Armed with molecular probes, they found a SARS-like coronavirus which was virtually identical to the pandemic virus strain in several species, but most often in the Himalayan masked palm civet cat, a member of the mongoose family, which is farmed in the area. Fortunately, these animals are not very widespread in the wild, but many experts suspect they are not the virus's natural host. They could just have acted as a go-between, picking the virus up from an unknown wild animal and passing it on to humans. So the natural reservoir of the virus in the wild is still uncertain. Blood tests show evidence of past SARS infection in 13% of Guangdong wet market traders and animal handlers, indicating that the coronavirus has jumped to humans living in this area before, and suggesting that it is likely to do so again. Indeed, 4 new cases appeared in China in January 2004, and although they were relatively mild and did not spread further, they are a reminder that the virus is still out there, waiting for another opportunity to pounce. SARS was the first pandemic microbe of the 21st century, but it will certainly not be the last. Ever since HIV emerged over 30 years ago, we have witnessed increasing numbers of new microbes, which are now hitting us at an average of 1 a year. While the SARS pandemic may be a preview of what is to come, it also gives us a glimpse of what our ancestors suffered over thousands of years. Unpredictable epidemics caused by lethal microbes appearing out of the blue, killing indiscriminately and spreading fear and panic. We were fortunate in knowing how to stop SARS, but as this book illustrates, our predecessors were not so lucky, and the consequences were sometimes devastating. In later chapters, we will look at well-known epidemic microbes, such as bubonic plague and smallpox, as well as lesser-known killers, such as the trypanosome and schistosome parasites. We will see how and why these and other microbes rose to prominence at different stages in our cultural history, and the profound effect they had on the lives of our ancestors. But first, back to the dawn of time to track the origin and evolution of killer microbes, to see how they spread and invade our bodies, and how our immune system responds to the challenge. 1. How it all began. When our solar system first formed, some 4.6 billion years ago, planet Earth was a very unfriendly place. Rather like the planet Venus today, Earth was so hot that carbon dioxide gas bubbled from molten rock and filled the atmosphere, causing such a massive greenhouse effect that the planet literally boiled dry. No living organism could survive under those conditions. But when Earth had cooled sufficiently for water vapor to liquefy just under 4 billion years ago, life appeared on the planet. This was not life as we know it today, but molecules that could replicate to produce daughter molecules with inherited characteristics. Darwinian evolution was set in motion, and eventually microscopic single-celled organisms evolved. These early life forms had to withstand Earth's highly volatile atmosphere, with toxic gases spewing from erupting volcanoes, dramatic electrical storms, and the sun's unscreened ultraviolet rays, all promoting uncontrolled electrochemical and photochemical reactions. The microbes around at this time probably resembled today's extremophiles, a type of bacteria so called because they thrive in all the particularly hostile corners of the globe. Extremophiles inhabit acid lakes, hypersaline salt marshes, and the superheated water issuing from hot vents at the bottom of the deepest ocean trenches, where they survive temperatures up to 115 degrees centigrade and 250 atmospheres of pressure. They lie buried 4 kilometers deep in the polar ice caps and lurk in rocks up to 10 kilometers below ground. Indeed, it is possible that life began with microbes in rocks deep underground, where the heat is intense and there is an ample supply of water and chemicals to get the whole process started. Extremophiles often congregate in coral-like structures called stromatolites, also known as microbial mats, because from the outside they look like doormats, flat, brown, and hairy. These are home to thriving communities of interdependent microbes, each utilizing another's waste to produce energy in a self-sustaining food chain or micro-ecosystem. Today, microbial mats can still be seen in corners of the world such as Yellowstone Park, Wyoming, USA, lakes fed by ancient aquifers in North Mexico, and along the shores of Western Australia, where the water is rich in chemicals and undisturbed by other forms of life. Ancient layered rock structures found in these places are thought to represent the fossilized remains of stromatolites that dominated aquatic ecosystems in the Archean Eon, 2.5 billion to 4 billion years ago. For around 3 billion years, bacteria had Earth all to themselves, and they diversified to occupy every possible niche. At this stage, there was no oxygen in the atmosphere, so they evolved many different ways of unlocking the energy bound up in rocks, utilizing chemical compounds of sulfur, nitrogen, and iron. Then around 2.7 billion years ago, a group of innovative microbes called the cyanobacteria, previously called blue-green algae, learnt the trick of photosynthesis, using sunlight to convert carbon dioxide and water into energy-rich carbohydrates. As a result, oxygen, a waste product of this reaction, slowly accumulated in Earth's atmosphere. At first, oxygen was poisonous to early life forms, but then other ingenious bacteria discovered that it could also be used to generate energy. These new energy sources were rich enough to support more complex life forms, but the emergence of multicellular organisms had to await the evolution of eukaryotic cells. Bacteria are prokaryotes, meaning that their cells are smaller than those of all higher organisms, eukaryotes, and have a simpler structure, lacking a well-defined nucleus. But around 2 billion years ago, a group of free-living photosynthetic cyanobacteria took up residence inside other primitive single-celled organisms to form the energy-generating chloroplast of the first plant cells. And in a similarly extraordinary maneuver, oxygen-utilizing microbes called alpha-proteobacteria became incorporated into other microbes as mitochondria, the powerhouse of animal cells. So finally, a mere 600 million years ago, the stage was set for the evolution of multicellular organisms made up of eukaryotic cells, and eventually the emergence of the plants and animals we know today. But compared to the diversity of bacteria, all other life forms, however different they may seem, are homogeneous, locked into the same biochemical cycle for energy production, and requiring sunlight for plant photosynthesis to generate the oxygen used by animals for respiration. We still rely on bacteria, in the form of chloroplasts and mitochondria, for these reactions, and on free-living bacteria for all other chemical processes needed to maintain the stability of the planet. These bacteria recycle the elements which are essential for life on Earth, and are at the heart of our balanced ecosystems, those complex, interdependent relationships that exist between plants, animals, and the environment. Although bacteria were the first to inhabit Earth, they are not the only microbes. Single-celled protozoa, including the plasmodium that causes malaria, probably represent the earliest and simplest forms of animal life, while the tiniest of all microbes, viruses, probably also evolved several million years ago. They have diversified to infect all living things, including bacteria, but exactly how and when they came into being is unknown. The genetic material of viruses consists of either DNA or RNA, but mostly only code for up to 200 proteins and cannot survive on their own. So viruses are obligate parasites, and only when they have sabotaged their host cells do they spring to life. Once inside, they turn the cell into a factory for virus production, and within hours, thousands of new viruses are ready to infect more cells or seek another host to colonize. Perhaps because they are so small, nowadays microbes seem to be overshadowed by larger forms of life, but they are still by far the most abundant on the planet, constituting some 25 times the total biomass of all animal life. There are well over a million different types, mostly harmless environmental microbes. They are in the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the food we eat. And when we die, they set about deconstructing us. Each ton of soil contains more than 10 quadrillion, 10 to the power of 16 microbes, many of which are employed in breaking down organic material to generate essential nitrates for plants to utilize. Every year, nitrogen-fixing bacteria recycle 140 million tons of atmospheric nitrogen back into the soil. Bacteria and viruses are also a key part of marine ecosystems, forming by far the largest biomass in the oceans. There are at least a million bacteria in every milliliter of seawater, most abundant in estuarine waters where they break down organic matter. Marine viruses control the numbers of these bacteria by infecting and killing them, particularly when they undergo a population explosion and produce algal blooms. In coastal waters, viruses greatly outnumber bacteria, reaching concentrations of around 100 million in every milliliter, and totaling an incredible 4 by 10 to the power of 30 in the oceans. Tiny as they are, if placed end to end, they would stretch for 10 million light years, or 100 times across the galaxy. As free-living organisms, bacteria have all the cellular machinery they need to grow and divide independently. They are between 1 and 10 microns in length, and most contain a single chromosome. When stretched out, this coiled circular molecule of DNA reaches to about 1 millimeter and carries up to 8,000 genes, which code for all the proteins bacteria need to survive independently of other life forms. Bacteria reproduce by binary fission, which involves making a copy of their chromosomal DNA and then simply splitting in two. Vibrio cholerae, as one of the fastest-growing bacteria, can accomplish this feat once every 13 minutes, and even the slowest growers like Mycobacteria leprae can double their numbers every 14 days. Given ideal conditions, a single bacterium could produce a colony weighing more than the Earth in just 3 days. But fortunately, conditions would be far from ideal long before that. Bacteria are masters at survival, and when adverse conditions come along, they are generally ready. Adaptability is the key to their success. Yet in theory, reproducing by binary fission yields offspring that are all identical to the parent, a process that apparently leaves no room for variability. But although their DNA copying machinery is accurate, mistakes occur which are corrected by a cellular proofreading system. Even so, occasional errors slip through unnoticed, and these heritable changes to the genetic code, mutations, may cause changes to their offspring. This is the basis of evolution by natural selection. In humans and other animals, evolutionary change is a slow process because of our long generation times, but for bacteria, which reproduce very fast and have a less effective DNA proofreading system, rapid change by mutation is their lifeline. A single bacterial gene mutates at a rate of 1 change per 10 to the power of 4 to 10 to the power of 9 cell divisions, so in a rapidly dividing colony, many thousands of mutants are thrown up. A few of these mutations will confer a survival advantage, and these progeny will then quickly outcompete their rivals and come to dominate the population. Bacteria have several other tricks to help them adapt rapidly to a changing environment, mostly involving gene swapping. Many bacteria contain plasmids, circular DNA molecules that live inside the bacterial cell but are separate from the chromosome and divide independently. They supply their host bacteria with extra survival information and can pass directly from one bacterium to another during conjugation. This involves the outgrowth of a filament called a sex pilus, which acts like a temporary bridge between the donor, male, and the neighboring recipient, female, bacterium, giving plasmids free access and allowing survival genes to spread rapidly through bacterial communities. Several genes that code for antibiotic resistance, allowing bacteria to survive in the face of antibiotic treatment, are carried on plasmids, and they have succeeded in spreading worldwide. Another way that genes can jump between bacteria is by using viruses called bacteriophages, or phages for short. All viruses are cellular parasites, and phages commandeer the bacteria's protein-making machinery to generate thousands of their own offspring, most of which carry a copy of DNA identical to the parent phage. But around one phage in a million mistakenly picks up an extra piece of DNA, either from the bacterial chromosome or from a resident plasmid, and carries it to the next bacterium it infects. If this extra piece of DNA codes for a protein that improves survival, then natural selection will ensure that the offspring of the recipient bacterium will prosper at the expense of others. Sometimes phages set up long-term symbiotic relationships with their host bacteria, with the phage being safely housed inside the bacterium and the bacterium in turn being protected from infection by other more destructive phages. Remarkably, the toxin that can fatally damage the heart and nerves during a diphtheria infection, and another that causes the catastrophic diarrhea of cholera, are both coded for by phages resident in the bacteria rather than by the bacteria themselves. Without their phages, Corynebacterium diphtheriae and Vibrio cholerae are harmless. At some stage in the distant past, groups of resourceful microbes found a niche in or on the bodies of other living things and evolved to parasitize host species. From that time on, the struggle for survival has shaped the evolution of both parties. On occasion, a comfortable symbiotic relationship developed, like, for example, the microbial communities that form self-sustaining ecosystems in the guts of their hosts. For ruminants, such as cows, the advantages of this partnership are obvious. The microbes are bathed in nutrients and protected from the outside world while they digest the cellulose in plant cell walls, which cattle are unable to do for themselves. In humans, however, the function of gut microbes is not so clear. We each house up to 10 to the power of 14 microbes, weighing in total around 1 kilogram and outnumbering our own body cells by 10 to 1. So far, more than 400 different species have been identified, which probably protect us from attack by more virulent microbes, aid our digestion, and stimulate our immunity. They are harmless as long as we are healthy, but if they manage to invade our tissues, perhaps through a surgical wound, they can cause nasty infections. Of the million or so microbes in existence, only 1,415 are known to cause disease in humans. But despite their significance to us, these pathogenic microbes are not primarily concerned with making us ill. The sometimes devastating symptoms they produce are really just a side effect of their life cycle being enacted inside our bodies. However, they certainly use each step of the infection process to their own advantage, and natural selection ensures the microbes that induce disease patterns that are best designed to assist their reproduction and spread survive at the expense of their more sluggish siblings. So over time, disease patterns have been sharply honed by evolution to ensure the survival of the causative microbes. A highly virulent lifestyle, killing the victim outright, is not advantageous to microbes, as they will then be without a home and probably die along with their host. Yet less virulent microbes risk being rapidly conquered by the host's immune system, and this also curtails their spread. Over centuries of coexistence of microbes and their human host, evolution has fine-tuned the balance between these two extremes to optimize survival of both species, but the rapid adaptability of microbes means that they are generally one step ahead in the ongoing struggle. Microbe spread. An airborne microbe benefits from a host who is well enough to continue their daily routine and so keep its chain of infection alive by passing microbe offspring onto other susceptible hosts. So while only causing us mild discomfort, common cold-like viruses colonize our nasal passages, making our noses run and tickling local nerve endings to trigger our sneezing reflex. This ingenious strategy produces a fine spray of tiny virus-bearing droplets, which remain airborne for long enough to infect a whole classroom, bus or train carriage full of people. And even if other airborne microbes, like flu and measles viruses, eventually confine us to bed, thousands of microbes have been shed by the host during the incubation period, well before the illness takes hold. Microbes that cause gastroenteritis have found a very efficient way of travelling from one victim to another through fecal contamination of food and drinking water. While reproducing in our gut, rotaviruses kill the lining cells, producing large raw areas which can neither absorb nor retain fluids. So body fluids leaking into the gut mix with dietary liquids, causing the profuse watery diarrhea we all know and dread. This efficiently flushes the viruses back into the environment, and with each gram of feces containing around 10 to the power of 9 of them, it is not surprising that the microbe easily finds another host, particularly in developing countries where around 1 billion people still have no access to clean water. Some microbes are too fragile to survive in the outside world for long, and so have to pass directly from one person to another. One of these, the infamous Ebola virus, which occasionally finds its way into the human population from an unknown animal host, causes epidemics of a highly lethal hemorrhagic fever. The virus punches holes in capillaries, and blood teeming with viruses oozes into tissues and body fluids. So while the patient is prostrate with high fever, severe pain, generalized bleeding, and catastrophic vomiting and diarrhea, the viruses in body fluids take the opportunity to pass to unsuspecting family members and hospital staff. Other directly transmitted microbes, such as those that cause syphilis and gonorrhea, have found a niche in the warm, moist surroundings of the human genital tract, exploiting the basic human instinct for procreation as a highway between victims. Many highly successful microbes use living vectors to ferry them between hosts, Often a biting insect will oblige by ingesting the microbe while taking a blood meal from one victim and then injecting it into the next. Vector-transmitted microbes often have complicated life cycles with essential steps in the vector and the host, so both influence the evolution of the parasite. The life cycle of the malaria parasite in humans has evolved to maximize its chance of being picked up by an Anopheles mosquito, the only insect that can transmit the disease. The parasite colonizes red blood cells, feeding on the oxygen-carrying protein, hemoglobin. And when 48 or 72 hours later, depending on the type of malaria parasite, the cells burst open, releasing a new batch of parasites into the bloodstream, the waste products from the parasite's meal trigger the high fever, rigors, and malaise characteristic of a malaria attack. These symptoms are severe enough to keep the sufferer lying still so that a grazing mosquito can take a full blood meal undisturbed. So in this case, synchronizing the debilitating symptoms with the release of large numbers of new blood parasites greatly enhances the microbe's chance of survival. Malaria and several other vector-transmitted microbes are restricted to tropical regions by their vectors, which require high temperature and rainfall to breed. But microbes which are not so fussy about the vectors they use can spread further afield. The mosquito-transmitted West Nile fever virus, which can cause fatal encephalitis, recently crossed the Atlantic to hit New York in 1999. Its usual homelands are in Africa, Asia, Europe, and Australia, where it uses a whole range of mosquito vectors. The virus is primarily a bird microbe, but humans can get infected when bitten by a virus-carrying mosquito. By exploiting the virgin populations of birds and humans in the U.S., the virus moved in a wave across the continent, reaching the West Coast, the Caribbean, and Mexico in just 4 years. Already it has colonized 284 U.S. bird species and utilized 58 types of mosquito as vectors. Clearly, the virus has established a base in the U.S. for the foreseeable future. Epidemics. Most pathogenic microbes constantly live on a knife edge. They are locked into a continuous chain of infection. One break in the chain and they are dead. So they must continuously jump from one susceptible host to another, infecting, reproducing, and moving on before the host's immune system wipes them out. Epidemics strike whenever and wherever microbes find a large susceptible group of people to infect, and can successfully forge a path between them. Given the right conditions, a microbe will rip through a population, infecting and perhaps killing until it runs out of people to infect. When all are either dead or recovered and immune to further attack, the microbe will move elsewhere and only return when there are again enough susceptible people to sustain the chain of infection. When an epidemic strikes, it is epidemiologists who do the detective work to uncover the cause, predict the size of the outbreak, and suggest effective control measures. A key number for them is R0, which represents the basic reproductive rate of an epidemic, that is, the average number of new cases infected from each case in a susceptible population. It is important to know the value of R0 when an epidemic threatens, because if it is greater than 1, then the infection rate is increasing and an epidemic is likely. Conversely, if R0 is less than 1, then the infection is not self-sustaining and it will fizzle out. Monitoring this value during an epidemic, now known as R, the case reproduction number, gives an indication of how long it will last. R is generally high as an epidemic takes off, and then falls as more and more people become immune to the microbe. And when it falls below 1, everyone can heave a sigh of relief, knowing that the worst is over. The R-naught value for a microbe encapsulates the whole chain of events that make up its life cycle, from penetrating and invading a host, infecting host cells and producing offspring, to finding a way back into the environment and locating another susceptible host. The success of these maneuvers depends not only on the microbe itself, but also on its host population and the environment they both live in. So the dynamics of an epidemic are defined by the microbe's transmission route, the length of its incubation period, the size and density of the susceptible population, and, if a vector is involved, its geographic range. For example, although sexually transmitted disease, STD, microbes can spread as widely as those that are air or waterborne, their epidemics move much more slowly and involve a more restricted population. Classically, STD epidemics begin in young adults and target the most sexually active. For R0 to exceed 1 on average, each case must infect more than one another. But in practice, 20% of those infected account for 80% of the spread. These 20% are super spreaders at the hub of large sexual networks, be they commercial, sex workers, or promiscuous gay men. HIV, greatly assisted by its long silent incubation period, averaging 8 to 10 years, encircled the globe by using these networks before it was even recognized. Indeed, the epidemic among gay men in the U.S. in the early 1980s was thought to be sparked by one superspreader, Case Zero, a city-hopping gay airline steward who had sexual links with at least 40 of the earliest cases in 10 different cities. In all epidemics, victims display a spectrum of disease severity varying from fatal cases on the one hand to mild disease on the other, and in most outbreaks there are also silent infections, with the microbe colonizing its host without causing any disease at all. Sometimes these silent infections form a sizable proportion of the total. In some flu epidemics, for example, up to twice as many people are infected as suffer any illness, and with polio, less than 1 in 100 of those infected come down with paralytic disease. But silently infected individuals are a major source of spread to others, since they remain well and are unaware that they are infectious. So, in order to calculate R0 and get an accurate picture of the size and progress of an epidemic, these silent infections must be detected by laboratory tests and taken into account. SARS coronavirus, being new to humans, has had little time to evolve with its new host and is not well adapted for spreading in the human population. It produces severe disease, killing 10% of its victims, and is spread in heavy mucus droplets, which can only travel a short distance, infecting close contacts. SARS victims are not infectious during the incubation period and do not shed the virus after recovery. Add to this the fact that during the pandemic, there were virtually no silent infections, and it is not surprising that R0 is in the modest range of 2 to 4. But despite all these disadvantages, the virus spread round the globe, aided by superspreaders like the doctor at the Metropole Hotel in Hong Kong, and fast international air travel. It is interesting to imagine how the virus would have fared if it had emerged hundreds of years ago, before we had any knowledge of how to stop it spreading. Would it have remained a major international killer, like smallpox, or would it have evolved into a milder form and joined the band of viruses that cause flu-like illnesses today? Host resistance. The battle between humans and microbes has been raging ever since Homo sapiens evolved, and was presumably ongoing in our primate ancestors long before that. From a present-day standpoint, it is hard to see how humans have been able to compete with the apparent ingenuity of microbes. but the story is one of co-evolution over thousands of years, and its history is written in our genes. Each time an infectious disease hit our ancestors, it weeded out the most susceptible, leaving only the more resistant survivors to pass on their genes to future generations. Thus, step by step, the population slowly built up genetic resistance to the whole range of pathogenic microbes, while at the same time, many microbes evolved to be less virulent. Consequently, most infectious diseases became less severe over time. Now we are all descended from a long line of forebears who survived epidemics and spawned offspring with inbuilt resistance, and it is thanks to them that we are here to tell the tale. The evolution of resistance is perhaps most clearly illustrated by the fascinating association between malaria and the inherited blood diseases thalassemia and sickle cell anemia. These mutations cause red blood cell disorders which are fatal in homozygotes, those who inherit mutated genes from both parents, if untreated. They should therefore have died out over time, but they have been retained in the human gene pool because they protect heterozygote carriers with one mutated gene against death from malaria. Over centuries, thalassemia and sickle cell anemia carriers survived, while many others died of malaria, and the frequency of these genes gradually increased, until now they are amazingly common among people living in areas where malaria is or was endemic. Today, up to 40% of sub-Saharan Africans carry the sickle cell anemia gene, and 70% of the Papua New Guinean population are carriers of various thalassemia mutations. There must be many similar undiscovered genes that enable resistance in the human genome, most of them probably coding for proteins which enhance our immune response, having been forced to prominence by the relentless onslaught of killer microbes such as smallpox, plague, and diphtheria. By constantly challenging our immune system, these microbes have helped shape it into a highly complex and sophisticated fighting machine, with a fast response mode to stall new invaders and a memory to prevent reinvasion. White blood cells are the mainstay of our immune system. There are many types of these mobile cells, including polymorphs, macrophages, and lymphocytes, which travel in blood and patrol the tissues, hunting for invading microbes and stopping them in their tracks. When a microbe succeeds in breaching our defenses, polymorphs and macrophages are first on the scene. They secrete chemicals called cytokines, which increase the local blood flow, opening up the region to other immune cells. This produces the red, painful swelling typical of an inflamed area, and also the non-specific flu-like symptoms, fever, head and muscle aches, and lethargy, we experience at the start of most infections. Macrophages are large, amoeba-like cells that engulf and digest invading microbes. Then, laden with microbial proteins, they make their way to local lymph glands where they interact with lymphocytes to initiate the later, more specific phase of the immune response. Lymphocytes are small, innocuous-looking cells, but they make up a formidable army which defends us against all comers. The body contains an incredible 3×10^9 lymphocytes, each with its own receptor that fits just one segment of a foreign protein. They circulate in blood and congregate in lymph glands, and when they meet a macrophage carrying a bit of foreign protein that fits their particular receptor, they are galvanized into action, growing and dividing to form a whole army of cloned offspring ready to deal with the invading microbe. B lymphocytes produce antibodies which mop up bacteria, while T lymphocytes are armed with chemicals which punch lethal holes in virus-infected cells. With these immune mechanisms in full swing, most microbes are routed, but a few have evolved ingenious ways of evading the attack or tricking the immune system into thinking they are part of the body's makeup. For example, Mycobacterium tuberculosis bacteria survive by living in macrophages which can engulf but not destroy them, while herpes viruses hide inside long-lived cells, often without expressing any proteins for the immune system to target. These silent, persistent microbes may emerge years later if the body's immunity is suppressed. On the other hand, protozoa such as malaria and trypanosome parasites can change the protein composition of their coat throughout their life cycle, so keeping one step ahead of the immune system, and HIV achieves the same end by mutating regularly. One of the most intriguing things about the immune system is its ability to remember past encounters with microbes and so prevent reinfection by the same microbe. This is achieved by retaining a few microbe-specific memory lymphocyte clones after an infection is cleared so that they are ready to respond rapidly at the next encounter. This prevents the microbe from getting a foothold the second time round and explains why, as a rule, we only get one attack of each acute infectious disease, like measles and mumps, in a lifetime. This immunological memory is the principle underpinning vaccination. Today, we regularly induce immunity artificially by giving a dose of a killed or weakened microbe, which tricks the body into responding, as if to the natural infection. This generally gives lifelong protection and prevents epidemics by interrupting the microbe's life cycle. But for most of our history, the natural cycles of infections held sway, and in the rest of this book, we look at their impact on human history. 2. Our microbial inheritance. Homo sapiens and his closest living relatives, the great apes, gorillas, chimpanzees, and bonobos, split from their common ancestor in Africa around 6 to 7 million years ago. Only a few scattered fossil remains are available to provide snapshots of his subsequent evolution through a series of hominids with progressively more erect posture, increased brain size, loss of body hair, and improved manual dexterity. One such hominid, Homo erectus, recognized in the fossil records from around 250,000 to 1.8 million years ago, abandoned the rainforest and began to hunt on the open plains of East Africa. This move, perhaps prompted by a change to a drier climate that increased the savanna area at the expense of the forest, eventually led to their migration out of Africa, so that by around 1.7 million years ago, these creatures had spread as far as Indonesia, China, and Europe. For thousands of years, these hominids roamed the land in small bands, gathering fruits, leaves, and roots, and using crude stone tools to hunt for small prey. All animal species have their own collection of parasites that have co-evolved with them over many centuries, and our ape-like ancestors were no exception. They and their parasites were part of the balanced ecosystem of the tropical African rainforests, and as long as the situation remained stable, host and parasite could continue to evolve together, living in a state of mutual coexistence which caused little problem to the host. At this stage it is impossible to say exactly what these parasites were, but although they may have weakened heavily infected individuals, they are unlikely to have been fatal. Modern humans probably evolved in Africa between 150,000 and 200,000 years ago, and a subsequent exodus, 50,000 to 100,000 years ago, eventually populated the whole of the modern world. These Cro-Magnon people are our true hunter-gatherer ancestors, and as exemplified by their famous paintings in the Lascaux Caves in the south of France, they were technologically and socially more advanced than their predecessors. They fashioned clothes and shelters from animal skins to keep out the cold, and made sophisticated hunting tools with which they could tackle large game without fear of being preyed upon themselves. For the first time, humans topped the food chain. These early hunter-gatherers are sometimes envied for their egalitarian society, and their lifestyle is idealized as being in tune with nature. On the other hand, the 17th-century English political philosopher Thomas Hobbes described life in the state of nature as a war of all against all,